8th Arts Council lecture. It's odd that a Welshman should be introducing such a well-known monksman to a decidedly monk's audience in English. I'm sorry about that. We'll make up for it at the end when a monksman will be giving the vote of thanks in what he would wish to deem God's own language. Dr. Stoll is in a line of distinguished monks, academics, who's been asked to give this lecture, who have made their name in England. The two previous ones were Sir Randolph Quirk and Professor Frank Kermode. They, of course, were experts in English. Brian, I think he prefers to be called Brian, is a physicist, and that's a conversation stopper in itself. Before he became head of physics at Liverpool, he worked in the Atomic Energy Authority, and that's another conversation stopper. When he became head of physics, it could have been said at that time that 90% of all the physicists that ever lived were still alive. I'm not trying to imply that Brian was old when he got that job, but that physics as a subject, as a science, was young. And in a young, challenging, vibrant, vital area of study, to make your mark, you have to be young yourself and vibrant and vital and challenging. And Brian certainly was that. It's ironic almost that he earned his bread and butter in a very young science, in a science that where hardly the first step in its development had begun. When his first love is for an ancient language, sadly, perhaps, in the twilight of its days. He's been helped in his pursuit of knowledge in that language by the fact that, by any definition you could care to make, he's an accomplished linguist. Most of us living in the English-speaking communities are monoglots. And we fail to see, sadly, why we should be anything else. And we feel and we think and we believe that the rest of the world is like that. Well, we're wrong. 80%, 4 out of every 5 of the world's population are bilingual or better. Brian is, wait for it, octolingual. I asked somebody in the office this morning, what do you call somebody who speaks 8 languages? And quick as a flash, she said, clever. And there's no doubting that. In his youth, Brian rubbed shoulders with the pillars of the Manx Language Society. Doug Farragher, Leslie Quirk, Walter Clark, and Billy Ratcliffe were his companions at one time when he was young. And in such company, he quickly learnt Manx. And I know that he's been grateful ever since for that experience. And he's ever since paid back that for that gift he was given then, and paid back in interest. And I shall simply content myself with reading some of his accomplishments. He helped to edit Doug Farragher's English Manx Dictionary in 1979. He had previously translated an Irish language course, Bunadis, into Manx, and had, with Robert Thompson and George Broderick, produced a Manx translation of the Chronicles of the Kings of Man and the Isles. he recorded an album of traditional songs in Manx in 1972. He helped to make films in Manx with Peter Maggs and again George Brodkrick. He wrote a course in Manx for Manx Radio, Abashen, in 1986-7. The one I like most, though, is almost his most recent. He translated in 1990 Alice in Wonderland into Manx, and I really hope that generations of Manx children in the future and their parents and grandparents will enjoy that. He's currently working on a GCSE course in Manx, and we are looking forward to that. But I think that currently the most significant thing about Brian is that he's here, or rather that after Christmas he will be here to stay. As you know, he has accepted the appointment of Manx officer to the government, the first of such appointments. And I think that he will look on that job as, even for him, the most challenging he's yet undertaken. And I know that you will join me in congratulating him and wishing him every possible happiness and success and fulfillment in that job. Thank you, Brian. I'd like to now ask you to give your lecture.
Well, thanks very much for that very kind introduction. I don't know how I can actually bear to go on after it. So thanks very much again. This talk, as the posters or the leaflets say, is very much a personal talk on my own views on the Manx language and on physics. As Mr. Davis said, if you say you're a physicist, this is very much a conversation stopper. And I've got the double advantage or double disadvantage of having two conversation stoppers here, the Manx language and physics. So it is possibly a great cross to bear, or two crosses to bear. But I want to try and convince people that it's not altogether an unnatural combination. I'm a physicist with a passion for Manx, and soon I'll be labelled as a Manx specialist who happens to have been trained and worked as a physicist. And what I want to, as I said, try and show is that physics can be regarded in many respects as quite similar to activities in Manx. The two activities are not really poles apart. If I lived in another culture, I wouldn't be regarded as such a freak. I think there's various aspects of the culture that we live in, which of course is an English culture, which is dominated by English social attitudes. Nothing wrong with this. I'm not saying this in a pejorative way at all. I think it's accepted by most people as possibly controversial, or as others by regarded as controversial. It's accepted by some others that the traditional English attitude to culture is one of suspicion. And it's not really a thing which is born very easily inside English culture in general. Also, it's traditional inside English culture to split people up into, if they're doing anything academic, into arts and science, which is a thing I've always found personally is rather strange. I might regard myself as lucky in that I would claim to go either way or both at the same time. But in other cultures, this is not regarded as strange at all. In certain cultures, say in continental Europe, it would not be regarded as strange at all for a physicist to be interested in languages. What makes it different, of course, here is that I'm interested, or more than interested, in Manx, which is a language which unfortunately has gone through very hard times indeed. And some people would argue that it's a dead language, which, of course, I wouldn't agree with. And if you'll bear with me, I'll just go through some of my personal history to try and explain how these attitudes have arisen in my case. When I was at the high school in Douglas, I had to make a choice. Did I do physics or Spanish? This was the brutal choice that was put in front of me. So I happened to choose physics. It might well be that I wouldn't be a physicist now if I'd chosen to do Spanish, because this would have been rather difficult. And as I was the first person in my family who went on for higher education, I didn't have, this is no sob story, these are just facts, I didn't have any advice from the family over this. I just made this choice and that was it. And I don't regret the choice at all. Also, you have to remember that this was the 1950s when attitudes were radically different from now as regards science. People at that time believed in progress, or a lot of them did. I can't remember whether I did or not. But nowadays, it's not fashionable at all to believe in progress. I certainly don't believe in progress in the sense of a naive belief in science and technology going on to solve everything, including the secrets of the universe. And it's certainly not true now that people believe in progress. I got the Manx bug in 1953. And this arose because I was at a loss about what to do. I think it could have even been New Year's Day. And unusually, there was a paper shop open on Douglas Prom. And I went down there and bought the Mona's Herald. And in it, there was an article about Doug Farragher. And he was lamenting the decline of the Manx language and the fact that hardly anyone was interested in it. And I read this article, and I had an instant conversion. I couldn't say it was a religious experience, but some people might argue it was. And after that, I could not get away from the idea that I just had to learn Manx. It was just an imperative that I had to act on. And I spent quite a long time from then trying to find how I could learn Manx. How could I do this? And this wasn't clear at all. Because at the time, people might think that the opportunities are fairly scarce now, fairly thin in the ground. They were practically non-existent in the early 1950s. And being at the high school, I was interested to hear that people at the boys at the high school then at St. Ninian's had expressed an interest in being taught Manx. There was, in fact, one of those periodic upsurges of interest and enthusiasm for Manx at a very minor scale here. But strangely enough, I hadn't been interested at the time. This was before Christmas 52, I suppose. But 20 or 30 boys had said that they wanted to be taught Manx. And they had found a class outside the school. And by the time I'd identified the existence of this class, it paradoxically had disappeared, as Manx classes do. It had come and gone. And I think Leslie Quirk, I'm not blaming Leslie for this, but Leslie Quirk had been taking this class at Clifton House, does it still exist, next to the museum. And I benefited from this by meeting Leslie. And he was, in fact, the first person I ever met who could speak Manx. And from there, I went on to get into the secret world of Manx. And believe me, it has been a secret world. And very few people in the island have been aware of its existence. And many people didn't know, and probably still don't know, that there are any people around who can speak Manx fluently. So I met Doug Farragher, Walter Clark, Charles Muir Crane, Charlie Crane, and others, Billy Ratcliffe, and especially Bernard Kane. I hope he's not too embarrassed by my talking like this. But a key feature in my learning Manx was the fact that I learned it at the same time as Bernard did, because I had a chance to learn Manx with somebody at the same time. And this was very important, taught me an awful lot. Because we used to go each weekend to Doug Farragher's depot. He was a partner in wholesale fruit business at the time in Ridgeway Street in Douglas. And we went there every weekend, virtually, the autumn, winter, 53, 54, and heard nothing but Manx for hours on end. And in fact, I never went to any formal Manx classes at all. I partly taught myself, and I used to go out on these jaunts at the weekends with Doug and the others, to some extent, on expeditions to make tape recordings of the native speakers. But I can't claim that I knew the native speakers very well, except getting to know Ned Madrill reasonably well and meeting John Neen on several occasions. But I can date the time that I actually picked up a reasonable knowledge of spoken Manx, because Bernard and myself and others went to a Celtic convention in Borth in Wales at Easter 53, and we spoke Manx together, spoke English together rather. In 54, Easter 54, we spoke only Manx. So it was possible under these probably unique circumstances to learn at least spoken Manx very quickly. And it was particularly interesting to me to see all the psychology of this at first hand, which I'll say a lot more about shortly. The whole psychology of the loss of a language, in fact, which I'm no expert on at all. But it is a strange fact to me that most people are able to accept the total change of a culture and the total change of a language and not regard it as a very great event. To me, it's a huge event. It's an enormous event, not least for the people who've lived through this. And of course, we're very much in living at this time, in on the tail end of this. But what struck me at the time was the great difficulty which people have in setting up any interviews, particularly with very elderly people who in some cases hadn't spoken Manx for some incredible time. There were instances of native speakers there who had not spoken Manx to any extent for 70 or possibly even 80 years, some incredible time, and some of it, a lot of it gradually filtered back. And there were all sorts of problems which I didn't have to deal with at the time, in fact never have, because unfortunately these people have all died off now, of setting up the interviews with them. There were problems with a huge pioneering tape recorder called the Sound Mirror, which some people here have definitely seen in operation, which operated with paper tapes. There were complicated negotiations made by Doug Farragher and the others to set up the interviews dealing with the relatives of the native speakers, checking that there was an electricity supply and all sorts of things like this. And one famous occasion I remember, we went to see one of the native speakers, who was, of course, very old, and the relatives were often very bemused by all this because they could not understand for the life of them, in many cases, why anyone would be interested in the fact their elderly relatives could speak Manx. And at this particular occasion, one of the daughters of this particular native speaker insisted on putting on for our entertainment, she was being very kind in fact, a very ancient record on a very ancient gramophone. And unfortunately, because of the sort of general nervous atmosphere, one of the Manx, the people trying to do the recording, started giggling, and which everyone fell about laughing, and the whole crew were ditched out of the house. And it took several weeks to set up the whole thing again. But this is a rather extreme circumstance. But it did bring home to me very clearly the extreme difficulty of the whole situation, because it's not an exaggeration to say that at that time, and even now, there were people around with deep scars over the whole thing in many ways. You can't change a language in the same way as you can change your clothes. You can't do this, you see, because the language is the main repository of any culture. You can, of course, have other very important aspects of the culture which live on and can be revived in many ways. Witness the revival in Irish folk music, for instance. But my belief is that the language is the main repository of any language. of any culture, rather, and when this is gone, you, in general, have lost most of the most important features of that culture. People, of course, in the audience here will be well aware of the main features of the history of the decline of Manx, but just briefly rehearsing these again. Manx was the majority language of the Isle of Man up until some undetermined time in the 19th century. And then, of course, English took over very strongly, and Manx was finished, essentially, as a community language once compulsory education through English came in, and it very much became a badge of failure and inferiority after that, although those signs were there already. And in a couple of generations, it went down very quickly, and the main aim of many of the people in the island then was to forget Manx as quickly as possible, which is understandable because if you think of the climate at the time, they were reaching the heyday of the British Empire. English nationalism was reaching a peak, and it would have been impossible, in fact, for a language which was as weak as Manx in every sense of the word to hold out against this. But it's still interesting to speculate what would have happened if there'd been even a minor provision for Manx in the 1870s Education Acts. It wouldn't, of course, be a flourishing language now, but it wouldn't have gone down quite as fast. And many of the people who still spoke Manx said things like, Hajini the Brech, cos na ping the Hon, it'll never earn you a penny. I could, of course, dispute that now, but but in general, this was true, you see, because they felt they had to ditch Manx as quickly as possible and learn only English, and English was the vehicle for advancement. But nevertheless, you've got this sort of tantalizing thing, what would have happened if, because, of course, the island is in close proximity to England, obviously, with a huge population there, with tourism coming in, the Education Acts, the language went down very quickly indeed. And I'm certainly convinced that many of the features attributed to Manx people, like just the shy and so on, possibly, very likely, arose because of this loss of confidence in losing the language and the general feeling that they were inferior. Without wanting to dwell on this too much, because there's probably going to be lots of Manx people jump up and say, I never felt like that, which of course is perfectly true. But it was very clear to me, for instance, at the high school in Douglas, that it was tacitly accepted all the time that in many cases where boys came from across, that they were leaders and they were more confident. They were expected to be more confident than the Manx kids. And in many ways, if you showed confidence and leadership, you were not being Manx. On a different tack, I remember I got embroiled at a fairly early stage because I seemed to have, from a very early stage, liked to have got involved in controversy, so shall we say, by writing, in my case, under a pen name, which was, I think, Brian Thomas, abusive letters, sorry about this, about Manx dialect. I was a purist, of course, you see, and I wanted to revive the Manx language, so the dialect had no place at all this. So eventually, an irate letter came back from a true Manx person saying, who is this Brian Thomas? He can't be Manx. No true Manxman ever rushed into print like that. So this is what I mean, essentially, about the whole thing. And this is true of any sort of place where the culture has gone down, and for various reasons people feel inferior. I'm not talking about, or not advocating people strutting around saying they're superior. I'm just saying that they lost this general feeling of confidence, which might have been there before, might not. And you have to compare it in fantasies with the situation, say, in Iceland, where, of course, you've got a totally different situation. But even in the case of the Icelanders, historically, at various times, they lost their confidence as well. But they're in a much more remote country with an intact literature, very ancient literature, and they've become certainly now a very highly literate nation in their own country, which never, unfortunately, happened with Manx. It couldn't develop that way. And again, dwelling on this aspect of confidence and so on, just to give one more anecdote to ram home the message, probably unnecessary for this audience, but here goes. Again, in the 1950s, I was with Doug Farragher, possibly Bernard was there, I can't remember, and we were in a church in Douglas getting ready for a Manx service, a service in Manx. And Doug walked into the church, this was allowed, it was that they were expecting us, and decided he'd check the acoustics, and he started reading out from the Manx Bible. And a man burst in, it turned out he was the caretaker, or something similar, and this man was completely beside himself. He said, "What are you doing spouting out that rubbish in here? That's no language." And he kept shouting this again and again, "That's not a real language. That's no language." And from what he was saying, he obviously knew it was Manx. And he just couldn't be calmed down at all. And we eventually made our apologies and just walked out of the place. And the point I'm trying to make is that even now, you can meet Manx people, generally older ones. I'm talking about traditional Manx people, not, how can I put it, new Manx. And you will generally, certainly in the 1950s, found the most hysterical reactions only from Manx people. People who were not traditionally Manx would, I could say, certainly my experience, never behave that way. They certainly, the non-Manx people would say, this is a waste of time. What are you worrying about Manx for? You should be learning French, German, Russian, and so on. But it's certainly true that the Manx people themselves have had this scar, I think, and you can still see traces of this. If I wanted to cause trouble in certain pubs I know in the Isle of Man, I would trigger off a discussion about Manx just before closing time. And not that I want to do this, but it is actually still quite a sore topic with a lot of people, but significantly not with the younger people, because the sad fact is, you see, that the older generations obviously died out now, and you don't get the same depth of feeling over it. There's a lot more support for Manx than there was. But again, significantly, a lot of this support, and this is a feature which has been there for a while, will quite often come from people who are not traditional Manx. Well, turning to physics, you may have wondered why I've called this talk Manx with Physics. And the reason that I've linked the two is not just my own personal experiences, but because there are many similarities in many ways. If someone had told me 40, 35 years ago that in these islands, if I can put it that way, certainly in England, the study of Manx and the study of physics were threatened topics, I would never have believed them. Because in many ways, I chose to do physics because I was excited by the subject, still am, and again, like a lot of people in the 1950s, was turned on by science fiction. A lot of physicists will tell you this, and having acted as the admissions tutor for physics at Liverpool Poly on and off for a large number of years, I can verify that many of the people on the application forms put this as a reason that they're interested in science fiction. And again, veering off at a slight tangent to show that there was an early connection in my case, because you could argue that I was passionately attached to Manx before I was passionately attached to physics. I did actually write a serial in Manx in English in one of the Manx papers. I've forgotten which it was when I was still at school. And this was called The Language of Paradise. And the theme of it was a well-tried one in science fiction, that is, of some distant world where you had this highly cultivated people. Science fiction theme is extremely common, where you've got these sort of all-wise beings in another world who tell us how to do things. But the main punchline here was they all spoke Manx in this other world. And I introduced into this some politics, which I thought was inevitable. It was quite interesting at the time that the editor of the paper objected to this, because what I put into it was aspects of the Cold War, that the Russians and the Americans set up all sorts of laboratories where they were training people intensively in learning Manx as quickly as possible, which is the sort of thing we need now. coming back to physics, they're both cultural activities. It's fashionable, certainly in England, without naming names, to regard cultural activities as useless. This is just a fashion at the present time. But I'd like to submit, I think there's massive evidence for this, that you're on a very dangerous path with this. You can't really separate out what's useless and what's useful. If you think of computers, the people here in the finance sector, and the finance sector anywhere on earth, are possibly unaware of the fact that many of the gadgets they're using, and certainly the computer networks they're using, to a very large extent, were developed by particle physicists. Now, the physicists didn't develop these initially so that banks could collaborate across national boundaries. They developed them so they could analyze all the data on particle physics experiments. I'm not here making some plea saying, please understand this, physics is useful. I'm just stating this as a fact. And it's timely to remind people, we've possibly seen this in the papers, that it's 200 years ago that Faraday was born, Michael Faraday, the great pioneer of physics and electrical technology. So Faraday had a huge part in the early development of virtually any electrical gadget you can think of. And there's the standard story which everyone tells about Faraday, that when he was asked by a politician, well, the politician made the observation about Faraday's experiments, this is all very interesting, but what use is it? Faraday answered, what use is a baby? And this is exactly the sort of thing you would expect these days. And again, a recent article about Faraday pointed out the danger of deifying him for current political reasons. The political orthodoxy, certainly in England at the moment, is that science can be left, stretching things a bit, to a few gifted eccentrics, and it doesn't really need an awful lot of funding, and if they want the funds, they can get them themselves. But again, pointed out in the article, it was in the English Independent newspaper, that in fact Faraday had a very long training, which went on for years and years, and he had probably at that time the best equipped lab in Western Europe, probably on Earth as regards physics at that time. And following his developments, the profession of scientist was created essentially in England, but for various complicated reasons, it fell by the way. I would submit largely because of the social attitudes. Again, I'm not whinging, to use another key word, I'm just stating this as a fact, that science and technology are not highly regarded in English culture. And it's an interesting fact that this sort of attitude possibly is spilling out, not from England, but it's happening in other countries. We'll come back to this later. And again, sticking with physics, the fashionable view at the moment, and again, people possibly don't realize that physics had a large amount to do with these sort of developments. If you go back to physics in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, the view arose that we're in a mechanical universe, the clockwork universe, which is the view which Newton's physics gave rise to. Now, Newton, of course, was a giant of physics, but he would possibly, if he was around today, be embarrassed by the view of physics which stemmed from the laws he discovered. And from Newtonian physics, the view arose, which is possibly an aberration of Newtonian physics, that you can measure everything. And this, I'd submit, is one of the idiocies going around at the moment. I'm not talking in any sort of obscurantist way here. I'm just saying that you've got to be careful about what you're claiming to measure. And if you're anything like a reasonable physicist, you've got to learn what the limits of error are. The people bandying opinion polls around should learn this, that it's plus or minus X percent error. And there's not necessarily any contradiction at all between various public opinion polls. They're all right, in inverted commas. And the view that you can measure everything more and more accurately is, in fact, outdated in physics. This is a thing which is not realized at all. And this is not speaking as an arrogant physicist. It's an unfortunate fallout from what you could say was the original view of physics, which was very powerful inside physics up to about 1900. And from this has arisen all sorts of aberrations, really, because the old-fashioned view of physics, which is still okay in engineering physics, is that you can calculate everything to reasonable accuracy, and everything is in terms of mechanistic attitudes. That if you've got a big enough computer, you can hammer out the answers eventually and get them more and more accurately. So to take an example, physics deals with models. It proceeds by taking a sort of idiotic view of things to start with, and it tries to refine them. So I would take an example of this. Before the nuclear plant was built at Sellafield, Windscale, whatever you like to call it, people were asked what would happen to the effluent that was dumped in the sea there. And they possibly asked some physicists about this, who replied, well, we make a model in our minds of the Irish Sea. And the Irish Sea is a rectangular lake, but it's got a big outlet at the top and a big outlet at the bottom. So the effluent, when it's pumped into the Irish Sea, will wash around and be washed out into the Atlantic. And it's no concern of ours, because the politicians would never say that. They would say, they would waffle on about the dilution would be so much, there wouldn't be any problems, and it'd be perfectly okay. But coming back to the main point, the model, in fact, was completely inadequate, because it turned out the model they should have chosen was of a landlocked lake. And if you go back to Celtic studies here, traditionally, over a very long time, you could regard the Irish Sea as a Celtic lake. And the inlets and outlets are not big enough. So what happens to the effluent is that it washes around to a very large extent near the Cumbrian coast. Some of it is swept up around the north of Scotland, but the bulk of it is deposited back on the Cumbrian coast. It doesn't go out into the Atlantic at all. Hardly any of it does. The point in going through this, this is a true story, in fact. The point about this is that the model is too simple. And what we're suffering from, in many ways, is the application on a very large scale of the ideas of Newtonian physics in areas which physics would never claim it is valid in, such as economics, where you construct a very simple model of the economy of a country, you get a computer to imitate what's happening, you put in various variables, and hey, presto, out comes the answer. Well, the predictions are only as good as the actual model. If your model is shaky, the predictions are completely wrong. And coming on to the more modern aspects of physics, quantum physics, which has arisen from about 1900, the physics people would only claim that quantum physics is valid inside nuclear and atomic physics. It turns out that in the subatomic world, you've got a completely Alice in Wonderland situation. That if you take this world and extrapolate it to the everyday world, you get raving nonsense. For instance, quantum physics deals in things like taking this into the real world or the everyday sized world. If I run at that wall over there an infinite number of times, a very large number of times, there's a finite probability that I will diffuse through the wall. All sorts of things like this, which of course are absolute nonsense in the everyday world. But it's been discovered that in many ways, in most ways, this is the accurate description of the subatomic world, that atoms do in fact smear into each other. The particles smear into each other. And there's a funny resonance of this in one of Flann O'Brien's books called The Third Policeman, which some of you might have read, where a man has a love affair with a bicycle, and he's so much in love with the bicycle that some of his atoms fuse into the bike's atoms and vice versa, so they sort of fuse together. Well, this is the sort of quantum physics idea that you don't deal in bits and pieces of everything. You take a holistic view which goes right across the board. And this is the connection that I would make with physics and Manx. They're cultural activities. You should stop this business of classifying things and everything, putting them in boxes, and take a holistic view. Because in the world of physics, the professional physicists would never claim any such thing, being hopefully very cautious people. But nevertheless, quantum physics, by some bold people, certainly recently, has been taken way beyond the narrow confines of physics itself, and unjustifiably in many ways, taken out into philosophy, religion, psychology, and all sorts of other fields where it probably isn't valid. But the general ideas are valid. Certainly, the idea that if anyone sets up an experiment, quantum physics says that the person who set the experiment up is part of the experiment, which you would agree with in everyday terms. If you go back to the opinion poll again, the person doing the opinion poll and the way the questions are asked are absolutely crucial because they affect the result. Similarly, if I go to the doctor and have various measurements made on me, the personality of the doctor will have some effect on those results. So the whole thing, everything is interconnected. And this is why lots of physicists are irritated these days by all sorts of mystics, not using the word in the bad sense, and people who are interested in holistic religions, religions of the East and so on, are using quantum physics to justify their view. And again, another aspect of physics which people here might not be aware of is the connection with politics, which rears its head in many places. And this is especially true of quantum physics, which not only irritates engineers to death, but because engineers have to use it these days when they're doing designs of electronic devices, because you've got to use quantum physics in a highly practical subject like electronic engineering now. But in terms of the way that various authoritarian regimes have viewed quantum physics, to give one prime example, in Nazi Germany, the people who were keen on Nazi ideology, whatever this was, regarded quantum physics as Jewish physics. And for this reason, they certainly didn't encourage the study of quantum physics. And again, possibly through a historical accident, possibly through the discrimination against quantum physics, the development by the Nazis of the nuclear bomb was correspondingly very much delayed because they put virtually all of their resources into rocket weapons. This was a direct instance of ideology affecting a scientific subject. And also, more or less at the same time, the Stalinists in communist Russia decreed that quantum physics, everyone disliked quantum physics, not only the students who have to do it, this was denounced by the communists as bourgeois mysticism, therefore not to be encouraged. But interestingly, the communists took a more pragmatic line than the Nazis and let their bourgeois mystic people carry on their work on quantum physics. And you can argue about whether spies did this or not. This is nothing to boast about, it's just a historical fact. Developed nuclear weapons. And it's also remarkable that there seems to be a connection between physicists getting involved in protests with authoritarian regimes, because the obvious ones in the case of later days in Soviet Russia were Sakharov, who paradoxically was largely responsible for the development of Russian nuclear weapons, who eventually turned against the regime and suffered all sorts of persecution because of this. Solzhenitsyn, the Russian writer, was trained originally as a physicist. And you've got all sorts of instances. For instance, if you look at the data in the American Journal of Physics, which has been coming out recently, a very large number of the physics departments in universities in communist China have been shut down because the people in those departments have been involved in protests against the current regime in Beijing. And in fact, the qualities which are needed if you want to be a good physicist will get you into trouble if you exercise these too much outside physics, that is, independence of mind, skepticism, and curiosity. After all, Galileo found this out with a vengeance. And this, again, it's interesting that the Japanese are having severe problems with this. The Japanese have brilliantly taken the methods of mass production because these very much need teamwork, and it seems that their whole culture is based on